Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Questions about the role of compassion in civic life, and especially in legal contexts, seem particularly germane to us in the early 21st century. Yet as Martha Nussbaum has reminded us, analysis of the issues involved goes back to the ancient world, with Seneca in particular offering a somewhat sophisticated distinction between mercy and compassion, and seeking to foreground mercy in an account of the worthiness of those who receive it. So I'm going to examine briefly Seneca's position on compassion and mercy. Seneca was writing in the first century CE, and his treatise on mercy or on clemency, which is De Clementia in Latin, was addressed to the young emperor Nero. Compassion or pity, misericordia in Latin, a morally bad emotion, is not beneficial to political society or in personal relationships. And this is this traditional Stoic position that Seneca is giving us. Seneca adds, however, that there is a virtue called mercy or clemency, clementia, which is not the same as compassion. Clemency is a tendency to pardon from or lessen punishment in such a way as to preserve the principles of justice. The legal context here is that there is a range of possible punishments available to the magistrate or to the judge to impose upon the criminal once he has been judged guilty of a crime. And so the question is, which of these possible punishments is going to be imposed? The harsher punishment or the more lenient punishment? I'm going to show you some pictures just to give you a sense of the forensic context of Seneca's praise of mercy or clemency. And these are from a trip that I took with the National Endowment for the Humanities several years ago. We went to Tunisia to see the former Roman colony, the remains. And I'm going to show you the remains of the Roman amphitheater in what was called the Roman town of Tisris and currently is called El Jem. So this was the third largest amphitheater in the empire. The first largest was the Colosseum in Rome. This one seated 40,000 people. And the first Gladiator movie, which I have not seen, but I know that there is now a second movie, which I also have not seen. The first movie has some shots taken in this amphitheater. So the seats are reconstructed. On the left-hand side, you see very modern-looking seating benches. Those are reconstructed, but the rest of it is the original infrastructure of the building. So it's quite massive and impressive. I'm going to go back quickly. The strip that you see in the center of the floor is the place where they would raise animals from. So it's a trap door. So you have to imagine that underneath the floor, there is essentially a zoo of animals that have been brought from all over the empire to be used in the games. Because they had games called the hunt, which were animals fighting with other animals, kind of like watching National Geographic, but live in person. And then they also had humans fighting against animals. So the animals were housed under the floor in cages. And then when it was time for them to come up for the games, they would use pulleys to open this trap door, and the animals would come up through that central trapdoor. You also have to imagine that it would have been painted all along the interior wall with scenery from from nature, right? To make it feel like you were out in the wild watching these animals. And they covered the floor with sand. Sometimes they even had fighting with boats. So they would fill the whole thing with water, and then they would have men and boats fighting with each other. The context of men fighting beasts is forensic, okay? Because one of the forms of capital punishment in the Roman Empire was to be thrown to the beasts. So if you've ever read any of the accounts of the Christian martyrs, for example, you have seen this. So one famous example is the Passion of Perpetua. Perpetua and Felicity are two saints that are mentioned in the Roman canon, which is Eucharistic Prayer 1 in the Catholic Mass, and they were martyrs, and we have an autobiographical account of Perpetua. Felicity was her slave, and they were killed in a different part of Tunisia in an amphitheater by being thrown to the beasts. Okay, so what they would do was starve the animals for a while to get them very hungry, and then put humans in there with the animals so that the animals were ravenous and they would just attack and try to eat anything. So this here that I'm showing you is a mosaic that was essentially a carpet. Okay, so this is a dining room floor, and it's quite massive. You have to imagine it's slightly smaller than the width of the front of this classroom, and then jutting into the portion where the seats are. Large, square dining room floor, effectively carpet, but it's made of mosaic. And so what it's representing is, in the lower left, you have the human being whose face is being chewed off by a cheetah, unfortunately. Okay. The platform in the center is where you go. If you survive, that's where you go to get your prize. Okay. So I'm showing you this to illustrate the cruelty and the bloodlust, which is described by Augustine, for example, in the Confessions, right? People would go to the amphitheater to watch these games, specifically to see the bloodlust and to see the violence, right? And so there's a total lack of what we would call compassion, right? I mean, this is your dining room floor, right? So you're eating dinner, and this is what you look down and you see. Just to give you a close-up to show you what I mean. This is a depiction of, this is effectively wallpaper. This is a wall mosaic that went all the way around the room. Again, it's someone's living room or dining room. And it's a depiction of the hunt. So this is where they have animals fight against other animals. Again, they make the animals very hungry so that the animals want to attack and eat each other. And the god in the middle is Dionysius. So the origin of these games was initially feast days of the gods, where the animals were sacrificed, or some of the animals were sacrificed to the gods. Then over time, it evolved into a kind of sporting events, right? So effectively, you're just going there for entertainment and no longer for a religious purpose, but it retains that kind of association with the gods. So in the story of Perpetua, the martyrdom of Perpetua, she describes that she and Felicity were dressed up as Roman goddesses, but in scanty clothing as a way of humiliating them, because they knew that the Christian women were very modest, so they made them wear headdresses and things and colors that would evoke the idea of specific Roman goddesses to the populace, and then they put them in like netting that was sort of see-through to humiliate them, and then they threw them to the beasts to be attacked and ultimately killed by the wild animals. So here again, I'm showing you the close-up. This is what you see on your wall as you're eating dinner or something. You see, I don't know what that is, a bear biting a bull, or a bull, it looks like. Here's another example. This is also a wall covering, two lions devouring a boar. And then this is the last example I'll show you, the last picture. This is when you enter the house of a Roman villa in the countryside in Tunisia. This is in the foyer on the floor. So obviously it's depicting a lion eating an ostrich that it has, you know, attacked and killed. And then there's this symbol that you see above the back of the lion. That is a symbol of a fraternity, a civic fraternity that the male head of household belongs to. So it's telling you when you go in that the owner of this house donates money to pay for the purchase of animals for the games. So it's telling you that he's a good citizen, he's upright, he's philanthropic, because he helps purchase animals to be in these very violent games where the whole focus is on bloodshed and sometimes capital punishment. Okay, so again, not much compassion happening here. All right, so Augustine claims in City of God 9:5 that his endorsement of compassion or misericordia is the distinctive feature of his ethics as compared to Stoicism, which regarded compassion as a morally bad species of emotion. So obviously we need to understand then the Stoic theory of emotions. So I'm going to briefly explain the main outlines of it. The Stoic theory has been much discussed because it is formally similar to the cognitive psychology and CBT model of emotional therapy found to be clinically effective today for certain conditions such as depression, anxiety, anger management, spousal conflict, and so on. Now, obviously, it's not a complete treatment plan, but the Stoics are talking about people who do not have neurological problems. All right, they're just talking about kind of your average person who has the average frustrations of life, or not so average frustrations, but the person doesn't have a psychiatric condition, is the point, okay? This Stoic theory was transmitted to Augustine by Cicero, writing in the first century BC, in the Tusculan Disputations, and also by Seneca. So Seneca wrote not only a treatise on mercy or clemency, but he wrote a treatise on anger, and he wrote many moral letters, which address sometimes emotional tranquility. He also wrote a treatise called On Tranquility of the Wise Man, and so on. We know that Augustine read these things because of what he says in City of God, books 9 and 14, also in his confessions and sermons. We see similarities to Seneca. Okay, so according to the Stoics, emotions are caused by judgments about past and future and good and bad. So I judge that something good or bad has happened or will happen to me. This causes psychic pain or pleasure, and that's what we call an emotion. Now there are four genera of emotions, four basic types. Fear is caused by the judgment that something bad will happen. Grief, by the judgment that something bad has happened. Desire results from the belief that something good is to be attained in the future. Joy is caused by the judgment that something good has happened. And then there are species of these genera. So there are species emotions about specific kinds of circumstances and objects. For example, anger is a desire for revenge, so it's a species of desire. Compassion is grief at another person's misfortune, so it's a species of grief. Now, the Stoics want to say that some emotions are good and others are bad, and the question is, what makes an emotion be good or bad? What makes emotions good or bad is the truth or falsity of the judgments that cause the emotions. The judgments are about an event's implications for the subject's well-being or happiness, and this being false or being true is what makes it be a good or bad emotion. Okay, so this is kind of important to linger on. It's not an error of fact that makes an emotion be bad. So if I am subject to an optical illusion and I believe that someone assaulted my mother, but in fact, no one assaulted my mother, okay, that error is not what makes it be a bad emotion. What would make it be a bad emotion would be if it's not actually bad that my mother got assaulted, but I believe it's bad and that I can't be happy if my mother got assaulted. Okay, so it's the value judgment that's really at issue in the Stoic analysis. So then we need to ask, like, well, what are the good things and what are the actual bad things? The Stoics held in Socratic fashion that only morally good qualities, virtues, are true goods, because only virtue is intrinsically productive of happiness. Cognitive therapy, therefore, is the training of one's thoughts in the truth that all exterior things are not really good. That is, they are not intrinsically good for us as moral agents, and therefore not worth becoming attached to. To borrow a term from contemporary therapy, the Stoics think that many of us fall prey to the cognitive distortion of dichotomous thinking. We tend to assume that many of the things that befall us are good or bad. Reality is much more varied, however, with a very large third class of things that are themselves indifferent to human happiness. Now, there's a further subtlety, because this large class of indifferent things is in turn subdivided into things absolutely indifferent, such as the precise number of hairs on one's head, things preferable because they have value, for example, physical health, intellectual acumen, social relationships, and things dispreferred, poor health, a low intelligence quotient, lack of friends, and so on. All right, so the Stoic good emotions, then, are the emotions that the wise person has. And they are caused by accurate judgments that a good or evil has been or will be lost or gained. So the wise person feels precaution, which is fear of doing something immoral, rational desire at the prospect of doing a good act, joy at having completed a good act, and there is no grief for the wise or virtuous person, because the paradigmatic wise person, being wise, would never consent to do something wrong. And the wise person knows that the only thing that is bad for him is wrongdoing. So then he has no reason to grieve ever, or she has no reason to grieve ever. Okay, so if you know any Greek or Latin, I know some of you here do, these are called, the technical term for these in Stoicism is eupatheiai, good emotions, or constantiai is how Cicero translates them, which is trying to convey a sense of tranquility, like an emotional state that is consistent with tranquility and about the right kinds of things. It's very important to note that this is not the typical caricature you see of Stoicism, right? So typically when people think of Stoicism, they think, oh, we have to be apathetic. We have to have no emotional reactions whatsoever. They are hard, right? They want us to be like Dr. Spock, but this is not what they're talking about, because they have this whole set of rational good emotions, okay? It's just that they are very austere and hyper-focused on morality. But if you are a virtuous person, a wise person, you're constantly in a state of joy for the Stoics, okay? Okay, now, the bad emotions, which are the ones that most of us schmucks have most of the time. Augustine describes these City of God 9:4-6 and in Book 14, Chapter 8. Failure to train one's thoughts in the truth results in morally bad emotions. These are called pathē in Greek, or perturbationes by Cicero, and effectus by Seneca. These are caused by false beliefs that preferable indifferent things are good, and dispreferred indifferent things are bad. It is incorrect to believe that the death of relatives, finding a spouse, being financially secure, living in a country that one can be proud of, and so on, are important for happiness. Such a person's fear is craven, his joy is exhilaration about frivolous matters, his grief is hysterical overreaction to things that are really irrelevant to happiness. These things are not productive of human happiness. In other words, they are not sufficient, and they are also not necessary, is what I should say in the parentheses. Only a fool assumes that these things are either necessary or sufficient for human happiness. Okay, so let's return to the particular case of compassion then. Recall that there is no grief for the paradigmatic Stoic sage, and thus there is no compassion, which is a species of grief. Because the wise person, being wise, never commits moral evil. That's the only kind of justified grief. Therefore, there's no compassion because there's no grief, because there's no sin or wrongdoing. Okay, so why does Augustine say that his position differs fundamentally from the Stoics is our question. That's where we started. The interesting thing is that even though he says that, he actually adopts the basic principles of the Stoic theory of emotions. So he agrees with them that the causes of emotions are judgments of the mind. This is different, if you want to think of a contrast, it's different from Plato's tripartite soul, for example. Okay, in Plato's tripartite soul, you have this idea that, at least in Book 4 of the Republic, that the appetitive part of the soul and the spirited part of the soul are just completely different sources of motivation from the mind and different sources of emotion from the mind. In the Stoic theory, all of our emotions start from the mind, from our judgments. They are cognitivists. And Augustine is too, okay? It's very important to see this, even though a lot of times we think of Platonism when we think of Augustine, that's true of his metaphysics, okay, but it's not true of his moral psychology. His moral psychology is very Stoic. It's very much based in this cognitive model. He also agrees that these are judgments, that an event is good or bad for us. So the kind of judgment that causes an emotion is the same for Augustine and for the Stoics. He also agrees that emotions can be classified as morally good and morally bad based on the truth or falsity of the judgment that causes the emotion. But he has three critiques of the Stoics' position on compassion in particular. So two are alleged self-contradictions of the Stoics. And then thirdly, he criticizes their value theory because he says it's partially wrong, not totally wrong, but partially wrong. Okay, so the first critique of Augustine is that grief about other people's moral failures is reasonable. According to the Stoic theory, compassion is about emotion, so therefore it should be about an indifferent thing, because that's what all the bad emotions are about. They're all caused by the false belief that something is good or bad, that is not actually good or bad, but merely indifferent. But there is a problem. The Stoics do not want the sage to grieve even when others are in true evils, even by their own definition of true evil. They need to provide some reason for holding that the sage should not have compassion for someone else's moral failings, and this reason seems to be lacking. How is the chorus in Euripides' Medea being irrational? This is Augustine's point when he says that sharing in the sadness of someone else can comply with reason. It can be reasonable. So the example I'm thinking of from the Medea by Euripides is the female character, Medea. She is very, very upset, angry, and jealous because her husband has committed adultery against her. And so the best way she can think of to get revenge is to take away what he values the most, apart from his mistress, who she can't do anything about. And that is, what do you think? What's the most important thing after your romantic interests? If you're married, you're a father. Yes, the children. Okay. So she decides the best thing she can do to get back at him is to kill their children. Naturally, right? Kill the kids. Gotta kill the kids. So the chorus, you know, the chorus is always kind of the voice of reason in these tragic plays. And so the chorus has a lamentation, basically for the soul of Medea, right? And so they start to say, oh, what a shame, what a pity, Medea is going to stain herself with the guilt of murder, her own children. How can a mother kill her own children, okay? And so the basic point, Augustine didn't read the Medea by Euripides because he didn't read Greek, but it's the same basic point, is like, how is the chorus being irrational in saying that? How is that unreasonable? The Stoics want to say there's no point in pitying the soul of Medea because the sage just doesn't have grief, so he doesn't have compassion. That's a species of grief. So there's no pity for someone like Medea for making herself worse. Now, the Stoics do try to offer a defense, but the only explicit defense they have is that compassion is impossible because this would be a kind of grief, and the sage, by definition, can have no grief, since the wise person never does anything morally wrong. We've seen this. But this is actually irrelevant to the question of grief over other people's moral failures, so they don't actually ever really address the issue. If the Stoic sage truly cared about virtue for its own sake, the matter of whether a virtue or vice were one's own or another's would not be a deal breaker. If what distinguishes a good emotion from a bad one is that its object is a true moral good or evil rather than an indifferent thing, it is not clear what is grounding the stipulation that the good or evil must be a good or evil of one's own. Hence, the prohibition on grieving over another person's moral vice looks arbitrary. It is not derived from the distinction between moral value and everything else, which is supposed to be the basis for classifying emotions as good or bad. And so Augustine says effectively, look, you Stoics are really secret Epicureans. This is very ironic because the Stoics and the Epicureans are arch enemies philosophically, right? So the Stoicism was developed in debate with Epicurus, essentially, okay, about the natural goal of life. Epicurus says the natural goal of life is pleasure, more specifically static pleasure, which is contentment or absence of pain. And then the Stoics push back and say, no, it's ontological wholeness or integrity or thriving. But here they are, basically contradicting their own principles and basically being Epicureans. So he thinks that what really motivates the Stoics is the following thought process. Most people are morally bad. Their lives are messy because of their own wrongdoing and the vicious behaviors of others around them, which entice them to become worse. Consequently, a sage who opened herself up to being emotionally impacted by others' moral failures would potentially be continually upset. Continually being lacerated by such pains is not an enjoyable, healthy way to live. So the sage's emotions should only be about her own moral states. This will reduce the amount of affective pain that the sage experiences to a negligible amount. So by refusing to make clemency a eupatheia, a good emotion, the Stoics are in fact, though not officially, advocating a version of Epicurean freedom from the painful emotions of fear and grief, ataraxia or aponia. But the Stoics, by their own eudaimonism, are not supposed to think that the avoidance of pain and the attainment of pleasure are proper goals of ethical action. That would be Epicureanism. They have thereby contradicted their own principles. All right, that's the first critique. Now, let's try to be as fair as possible to the Stoics and say, does he do full justice to the Stoics? Specifically, does Augustine take seriously enough Seneca's distinction between the virtue of clemency or mercy and the passion of compassion? Because remember, I said at the outset that Seneca thinks there is a virtue called mercy. So what is that? As mentioned at the outset, clemency for Seneca is an inclination to dispense with rules governing retribution whenever circumstances indicate that the principles of justice have been satisfied, typically that the guilty person has learned his or her lesson. They think that moral reform is the purpose of punishment rather than simple retribution. This implies two things. First, it is acceptable to remit punishment if the end is attained before the sentence commences or during its duration. Second, it is a lack of virtue to continue punishing after there is evidence that the guilty party has learned the lesson. This would be the passion of anger, a desire for revenge in which inflicting suffering is erroneously conceived of as a good by the angry person. So obviously, this is in the forensic context. As I said at the outset, it's about a judge or a magistrate deciding between different punishments, whether to choose a lesser punishment or the greater one, or whether to dispense with a punishment through a pardon. But you can apply this much more widely if you think of parenting and disciplining children, for example. What do you do with your teenager when they break their curfew, right? Or what do you do with your 7, 8-year-old when they go against the rules that you've taught them? Clemency is a sensitivity which recognizes reasons for lightening a sentence. Examples given by Seneca are, the perpetrator is old and frail, and so he learns his lesson with a light punishment because he feels it more. The perpetrator is repentant, or the perpetrator is young and inexperienced, and thus was acting from only partial voluntariness, and hence easily regrets the action. You can see here that there is a development going on from the discussion in Aristotle about different degrees of voluntariness, especially ignorance. What the Stoics decry is mercy, which acts from feelings of pity without regard for justice. Sentimental people want to throw open the doors of prisons and let out the most harmful criminals if once they see them cry, Seneca says. This is what Seneca calls compassion or misericordia. So again, to go to the analogy of parenting, right? We all, I think, have seen examples of maybe bad parenting where the child is spoiled, right? Because every time the child gets in trouble, and they start to be punished, they cry, and then one of the parents is too soft-hearted, right? And they say, oh no, he's crying, we can't let that happen, we can't. And so they don't carry the punishment through, right? So the child doesn't really learn their lesson. They just experience pain immediately from it and express grief, and then the parents call off the punishment. So now that we know what mercy or clemency is, it looks a lot more attractive than compassion, at least for anyone who, like Augustine, is committed to a virtue ethics in which deviations from justice are conceived of as harmful, both to the person who is treated unjustly and also to the moral character of the one who acts unjustly. Obviously, you make the person worse, right? If they don't actually learn their lesson because they're not punished enough, you make the person worse, they become morally worse. And this is why we talk about spoiled children being the faults of the parents, right? Okay, so Augustine retains the essential feature of Stoic clemency. So he does uphold the criterion of justice in mercy, not only in City of God 9:5, but also in letters dealing with the punishment of criminals. So there's a very interesting set of letters by Augustine that are collected in a volume called Augustine Political Letters, I think. Political Letters and Sermons, actually, is the title of the volume. The translation is by Dodaro and Atkins. And the letters are ones that Augustine wrote to Christian magistrates. He's trying to sway them in the application of punishments under the law in choosing between the harsher punishment and the more lenient punishment, and then he gives reasons. So there are a number of interesting case studies. So in this case, this is not a letter to a magistrate, it's just an admirer of Stoicism who writes to Augustine, just kind of an educated person who wants to know what Augustine thinks about various issues. And he says, the letter writer, that criminals should not be subjected to beatings, because the scars are always a fresh source of shame. So if you're beaten, you'll get scars, and then for the rest of your life, you will have that embarrassment of having scars. And Augustine basically says that's not a good reason. Like, the mere fact that somebody's going to be embarrassed by the fact that they got beaten is not a good reason not to beat them, because they need to learn their lesson, so they need to have a punishment. and maybe the beating is the most appropriate punishment. Maybe it's not, but give me a different reason. Okay, you can't just tell me that like the mere embarrassment, the pain of embarrassment, is a good enough reason not to beat somebody. Even when he uses the word compassion, misericordia, he says our ultimate criterion of compassion should not be what the perpetrator of the crime finds subjectively bearable, but what his true, that is, his moral interests are. So to take the case of physical torture, he definitely wants to avoid the use of torture. I mean, he's not using it at all, but he wants magistrates to avoid the use of torture. And he says it's abhorrent to a Christian way of thinking. And this is why he didn't press criminal charges against the suspected instigators of a church burning and looting in his diocese, who would have been subject to torture under interrogation. But he still thinks that some proportionate punishment must be imposed. You cannot just pardon people. And so he says, if you can establish that the people are guilty, I think you should give them a heavy fine as a punishment instead of a beating or torturing them. And he says, I'm doing this because of compassion. The heavy fine is the kind of fine that you have to work years to pay off, by the way. So when I say heavy, it's truly heavy. And he has this whole calculation about, I mean, it's not a literal mathematical calculation, but a principled way of calculating, which is it should be that they have to pay enough for a long enough period of time to make restitution for what they have done and to learn their lesson. However that can be quantified, learning the lesson. It means when they really show they've learned the lesson and they really are reformed. Plus, it can't be so heavy in any given week or month that they're destitute. Because if they are, then you are giving them incentive to steal. So then they will engage in more criminal activity. But the reason that he says he doesn't want them to steal is because it will be bad for their soul to steal. It's not a utilitarian argument like, oh, it's worse for everybody else if they go out and steal, or a consequentialist argument of any type. It's they're going to become worse if the fine is too much to pay in any given month or week. So it may go on for years, is the point, when I say heavy fine. Okay, however, this is another crucial subtlety. He thinks that if the less severe punishment of the fine, which may go on for years, cannot be secured from the magistrate, then the full force of the law is preferable to a simple pardon. And recall that this is how Augustine understood his own childhood beatings, which he compared to torture in Confessions 1. He says he goes to school and his teachers beat him because he wasn't doing his homework, which was disproportionate reaction. And then when he went home, his parents laughed at him for being beaten at school. And it's a very interesting analysis that he gives, because he says, I definitely deserved a punishment, right, for not doing my homework. It's just that the punishment was too harsh. But it was better that I be beaten than that I get off with no punishment at all. This compassion that Augustine advocates is therefore highly moralizing and subject to the demands of justice, as is Seneca's clemency. So this raises a puzzle for us. Why does Augustine insist on calling this compassion, misericordia, a term by which Seneca denoted an emotion that shows a lack of consideration for justice? And the answer, I think, is that Augustine's disagreement with Seneca is primarily directed at his restricting of clemency to a virtue pertaining to actions alone, a disposition towards externally doing things. The problem is that Senecan clemency is an officious set of deeds, or disposition to perform an officious set of deeds, without effective involvement. It has the look of an efficient bureaucrat dispensing aid to anonymous recipients. So Augustine says in City of God 9:5, it would have been much more humane for the Stoics to have praised a feeling of compassion. In other words, Seneca did not go far enough when he said that clemency is a particularly humane virtue. Augustine wants clemency to be defined as a feeling, a good emotion accompanying a tendency to do good works or to punish justly. He thinks that in this life, the sage will be subject to feelings of this kind even while performing morally appropriate actions. If you think of Aristotle again, Nicomachean Ethics, maybe a text that people have read more commonly than Augustine's Confessions or City of God, Aristotle divides virtues into virtues of the emotions and virtues of action, right? So justice is a virtue of action because it's about giving people what they deserve. But then there's gentleness or mildness, which is a virtue of emotion, which involves not being excessively angry, right? And so what Augustine thinks is that clemency really should be in both categories, or it should have aspects of both, dimensions of both, because we should be like the chorus in Medea, okay? We should be about not punishing people too excessively, but also not letting them get off the hook because it saddens us if they are morally bad and if they become morally worse. Okay, like what he said about giving people a fine but not fining them so much that they're destitute because then they will steal, which will be becoming morally worse, okay? That's compassion, right? So that's the affective dimension is part of it. Okay, so he's making this kind of funny terminological choice. He's using the term misericordia to allude to a clement emotion because it's the only term that the Stoics have for an affect that is concerned with the ills or misfortunes of other people. So he's adhering to some elements of a conceptual distinction between two senses of mercy while denying that one need stick to the technical Stoic names for particular affects. Okay, so then we have the next major question, which will bring us to the two final critiques of the Stoics. This question is, why is it so important to Augustine that we sympathize with the people whom we help? Because we might say, look, Dr. Spock, you know, if you just teach him about clemency, the principles of justice and mercy, he would be a great magistrate. Like, why should we care whether he feels anything about the people that he's punishing and the state of their soul or anything like that? So it's a fair question, and we need to see what Augustine has to say. So the first answer to the question is the second critique overall of the Stoics, and this is that the Stoics contradict themselves about the social nature of human beings. The Stoics themselves emphasize the eusocial nature of humans in their philosophical anthropology. So eusocial is a term used in biology. It just means we are the most social of all the social animals in the animal kingdom. This is part of the Stoic theory of instinct, which in Greek is called oikeiosis. Augustine uses the Stoic theory of instinct in one of his sermons. He calls this human charity, which even the pagans have. So here's a quotation from the sermons. Which of them, the pagans, after all, does not naturally love wife, children, brothers, neighbors, relations, friends, etc.? So this kind of charity is human. So if anyone is affected by such harshness that he loses even the human feeling of love and doesn't love his children, doesn't love his wife, he isn't fit even to be counted among human beings. It follows that to be a virtuous human is going to entail caring about other people's moral states in the sense of seeing them as goods relevant to one's own happiness. So happiness requires having a disposition that results in emotions regarding others' moral states. So because I love my children, if my children become thieves and they have a bad moral character, that pains me. This is normal. This is like fully consistent, okay, with what the Stoics say about the social nature of humans. But then they turn around and say that we shouldn't have any emotions. I shouldn't grieve if my son assaults somebody. The third and final critique, it's symptomatic of a faulty valuation of embodied human life. Augustine wants to allow the physical and social hardships of others, in addition to their moral states, to be proper objects of compassionate clemency. He follows Cicero in arguing that the Stoics preferred indifference are not merely indifferent to our happiness, but are actually good ontologically and consequently can be good for us. That is, real contributors to the happier and happiest lives. Love of neighbor, in other words, human charity, entails wanting these other things for other people. So remember, the preferred indifferent things are like wealth, physical health, physical beauty, intelligence, having friends, etc. So if we think of the case study of the people who looted the church in Augustine's diocese, and then the possibility that they were going to be tortured, Augustine diverges from the Stoics in his underlying assumption that torture is truly bad for the one being tortured. Might seem obvious to us, of course, it's bad to be tortured. But remember, the Stoics say it's a dispreferred indifferent thing. Okay, because of the harm done to the body and the accompanying physical pain. And it's not merely bad because it shows a moral defect in the torturer. Corporal punishment is thus something to be feared and sorrowful about, even if it is preferable to no punishment at all. Again, this is similar to Augustine's understanding of his own childhood beatings. He extends this to guilty criminals as well as their victims, this concern about the lesser goods, or what the Stoics call the preferred indifferent things. So in the year 428, merchants were abducting free people from the African coast and selling them as slaves in other provinces. Augustine writes to the other bishops in the area, and he says he feels the urgency of working to free these people. If he and the other bishops do not have compassion on them, he worries, then no one else with enough clout will be effective. To be effective, will do so. And yet, compassion should extend to the slave traders themselves. He desires that the culprits should not face the possibility of punishment according to the applicable law, since it prescribes beating by whips chipped with lead, which can lead to death. He suggests prosecuting them under a different law that can also be construed as relevant, which would entail a more prudent punishment. Note that Augustine is not opposed to the death penalty in principle, but he states that it is better not to use it because not using it can have a good consequence. It affords the criminal more time for repentance. Instead, he again advocates a fine, sufficient to render them incapable of pursuing luxury and pleasure, but not so much that they are left completely destitute, since the latter would give them a motive to commit more crime to provide for their necessities. The difference between Augustine and the Stoics very clearly lies in Augustine's statement that the trafficking of free people is a real, quote, evil that has befallen Africa, one meriting grief. On hearing about the misfortunes of these people, he says, hardly one of us could restrain his tears. It also lies in his belief that the use of lead-tipped whips on criminals is an evil to be avoided because it can lead to death, the destruction of the body. It is the Stoic refusal to call such things bad for the one who suffers them, which prompts Augustine to say that Stoic ethics falls short in its failure to include misericordia. In Augustine's system, the emotion of compassion is caused by an accurate judgment about the loss of real goods, although he will want to retain a distinction in magnitude between temporal goods and eternal goods. The properly compassionate person cares more about someone's moral state than about their physical state, but should care about their physical state. Here again, the question of precisely what differentiates Augustine's account from that of the Stoics is somewhat complex. So I'm just going to briefly consider the argument of Martha Nussbaum in a book that is now a bit old. It's from 2001, called Upheavals of Thought. But she discusses this topic without talking about Augustine, which was her main mistake. So Martha Nussbaum is very famous. I don't know if you're familiar at all with her, but she is a professor at University of Chicago in the philosophy department and also the law school. So Nussbaum stands up for the Stoics, basically Seneca, okay? And she says, part of what motivated the Stoic repudiation of compassion was a respect for persons as dignified agents. Their view was strongly egalitarian and cosmopolitan, being rooted in a conviction that humanity has dignity by virtue of its power of choice, prohairesis in Greek. Compassion is bad, she says, because it fails to give adequate attention to the natural dignity of the person, since it focuses on accidental features of the suffering person's life, on what has happened to someone, rather than on his or her rational capacity for moral choice. This is a bit like, this is not anything she directly says in this book, but if you want to think of an analogy in contemporary discourse, sometimes people would like to, will say, well, I don't want people to think of me as a victim, right? You don't want to be thought of as just the sum total of your weaknesses, or you don't want to be identified with any of your defects or weaknesses or misfortunes. And so she's saying that, you know, when the Stoics criticize compassion, that's what they're criticizing. They're criticizing people identifying other people with their misfortune, when what really matters is that they're moral agents who can choose the right moral action, right? Because what matters is morality. Effectively, this is kind of a neo-Kantian reading of the Stoics, right? And so she's endorsing what she's calling the Stoic view because she likes the Kantian ethics. Okay, now, it is true that the Stoics imply that compassion devalues a human being. The Stoic execration of compassion seems to be rooted in a refusal to identify a person with his or her bad fortune. Seneca speaks of self-congratulating pitiers who are averse to the people that they pity. They shrink from contact with the handicapped, the elderly, and the destitute. They insultingly fling their alms while averting their glance. Apparently, such people are repulsed because they make this false identification of bad or repulsive circumstances with bad or repulsive human being. Perversely, they also like there to be needy people because it provides an opportunity for them to look compassionate and to feel proud of themselves for acting compassionately. They do not regard the recipients of their alms as equals, but as inferiors. Now, this Stoic point is insightful and, again, rather attractive, as was their earlier stipulation that compassion ought not violate justice. But the viability of the Stoic attempt to articulate what does constitute human dignity is questionable. And I'm going to have to disagree with Nussbaum's interpretation. The whole emphasis of Stoicism implies that the dignity of a person resides in her acquired moral character. So she wants to say it resides in prohairesis, which is the ability to assent to the proposal to do an action, okay, to be a moral agent. In Epictetus, the Stoic author who actually makes extensive use of the notion prohairesis, the term does name a rational power for making moral choices, but it also not uncommonly names the dispositions acquired through the repeated use of this power. Thus, prohairesis has qualities in the Stoic view, in Epictetus' view. It is either morally beautiful or morally ugly. More importantly, the power of free choice is valuable as instrumental for attaining the right kind of disposition, for becoming beautiful morally. When the Stoics execrate compassion, then, they are not making a distinction or a choice between identifying someone with her bad fortune and with her rationality per se, but a choice between identifying someone with her bad fortune and with the way she uses her rationality, that is, her moral character, her actual moral character. If you act contrary to virtue, the fact that your action was preceded by assent means that you acted from a failure to reason well, and also that you acted voluntarily. If you persist in making bad choices, you will certainly lack the moral identity which merits admiration. It is by no means clear from what the Stoic sources say that I still owe you respect. It would, moreover, be irrational for me to have solicitude for your moral excellence, given that your state is voluntary. We are lacking a robust account of inalienable dignity that can unfailingly command respect for people simply as human and solicitude for their moral good, even when they have voluntarily made themselves bad. So we are lacking an account of dignity that can adequately ground an egalitarian Stoic mercy, such as Nussbaum wants. Now, once again, Augustine takes the insight from Seneca that the appealing feature about the perverse pitiers, okay, but he doesn't take on board the problems that come with it because he revises aspects of the theory. So in Augustine, we find the same insight that we do in the Stoics, namely that there is a kind of feeling sorry for unfortunate people that is in fact demeaning and perversely desires the bad fortune of those whom it pities. This is a quote from one of his sermons on the first letter of John. We should not wish people to be wretched so that we may be able to practice works of mercy. If you render service to a wretched person, perhaps you desire to extol yourself before him and wish him to be subject to you because you have benefited him. He was in need, you bestowed. You seem to yourself greater because you bestowed than he on whom it was bestowed. Wish him instead to be your equal. The compassionate clemency that Augustine advocates therefore seeks to avoid this kind of demeaning compassion, but unlike the Stoics, he grounds compassion in a robust account of human dignity that they don't have. And this is his ontology, his ontological account of the human being, which is deeply indebted to Plotinus. So Plotinus is a 3rd century AD Greek philosopher teaching in Rome, Greek-speaking philosopher teaching in Rome, Neoplatonist. So what do I mean by ontology? The position of Augustine is the soul is the image of God, the body is the image of the soul. The soul is a superior kind of substance to the body, and its intellect is an image of the mind of God, making it immortal. This ontological excellence justifies lamentation at the fact that people defile their souls with moral evil. So if we think back to Medea again and the chorus lamenting her, defiling her soul, now we have a metaphysics that would support that. The body has borrowed dignity, given that the intellectual soul forms the body. So it is not irrational to grieve if someone is tortured or their corpse is left to be eaten by birds, nor to fear that these things may happen, or get angry at people who want to do them. This ontological goodness of the soul, and therefore of the body, which is prior to and distinct from acquired moral character, allows Augustine to say that human beings deserve a certain protection and respect regardless of what they have done, regardless of their acquired moral character. Compassion is compatible with and even demanded by the virtue of justice because the ontological excellence of the person merits care and concern. So we haven't spoken about Christianity in particular at all so far, right? Everything that I've said is Augustine saying that he starts in the Stoics, he says they're incoherent, and then he fixes them by making them coherent with themselves, right? And then he adds Neoplatonism. But Plotinus was a pagan. So this is very different from what you hear many times. People will say, oh, mercy is a Christian idea, right? And it comes from the Bible, it comes from the New Testament. Well, that's not really true, as we've seen, okay? But now we can ask, is Christianity just totally irrelevant then, or is there any role that Christianity plays in this new theory that Augustine gives us? Relevant claims specific to Augustine's Christianity are extensions of the ontological points. So, for example, he says, by the manner in which the incarnation was accomplished, God showed the goodness of both male and female bodies. This is a pushback against ultimately Aristotelianism, but proximately Tertullian, who's a different early Christian author. The claim was that the female body is a malformed male body. So female bodies are inferior to male bodies. Okay, and so he disagrees with that. And he brings in Christianity to support it. He says that God became incarnate as Jesus in a female body, but having a male body. And this shows that they both have equal dignity. And then he says the reason why God wanted to redeem the human race is because of the ontological beauty of the human soul. The fact that it's a superior type of substance to the body is beautiful. Okay, so overall conclusions. In Augustine's schema, the effectively healthy person ends up looking tougher than the Stoic sage because more willing and able to bear effective pain. The person is more willing and able to bear effective pain. Clemency is not merely a disposition to do helpful things for others, but also to be sensibly affected by their suffering. Paradoxically, then, the toughness consists in a general softness towards the condition of others that is lacking in the Stoic schema for the preferable and different things and for the moral degradation of other people. What prevents this softness from being mere sentimentality, as the Stoics feared, is the same thing that provides a more adequate justification for the clement actions of the sage than Seneca himself had provided, Augustine's Anthropology. I'm just going to give you a few pictures again at the end, like dessert. We had the appetizer, we had the pictures in the beginning, then I gave you like the tofu, the hardcore, the protein theory. Now I'm going to give you a little dessert pictures. I wanted to just illustrate for you kind of this Christian worldview, which I saw in Tunisia, some more mosaics. So we can think of the Stoic Epictetus in the Enchiridion. One of the things he says is, when you say goodnight to your child, think that he may be dead in the morning. Do this to remind yourself that family members are preferred in different things. They are not items necessary for happiness. And the contrast with the Christian graves in particular, the Christian graves in Rome and North Africa, is quite strong because they record the number of years, months, days, and also how many hours the child lived when a child is buried there. So, for example, this one, we need a classicist here, a volunteer to read. Anyone? I'll tell you what it says. It says, Beata Maria Crispina vixit annis. So she lived the following number of years, 8. Mensipus, and then 10. So 8 years, 10 months. Diebus is 24 days. And then that theta, Greek theta, is to represent age, aura, hours. I guess that is the number 8, actually. Excuse me, the number 8? I'm a little unsure now. And then it says, I see. Yeah, it's auras. I was right the first time. It's hours and then 6. And then there's a D, which is the beginning of the next word, dormit in pace. She rests in peace. So she lives 6 hours on the 24th day of the 10th month of the 8th year of her life. She died. Right, so the physical death of the child, right, is obviously something that they're grieving about. They're not saying what Epictetus said, which is like, well, it's dispreferred that she died, but, you know, let's move on. This is most beloved daughter, Anna. Alicia or something is the second name. And then Bixit in pace annis. So she lived the following number of years in peace. She rests in peace. Annis 10, so 10 years old. Menses 8 months, 21 days. RIP, rest in peace. Requiescant in pace. And then 6 is the hours. And then it says Ides of October. It's telling you the date on the calendar that she died. So again, they're counting down to the hours. And then this is the final slide. This is not a child. This is a deacon in the church. You see the key row at the top and the Alpha Omega, which was in the other ones, some of the others as well. That one has the key row at the top to represent Christ, and then Alpha Omega. And then the second line of this, very hard to read, but at the top, the second line, it says, Pauperum Amator, lover of the poor, cultor Dei, worshiper of God. And then below, it tells you he was 43 years old. So again, loving the poor, again, not really something you see in the Stoic theory, at least not as an effective involvement with the poor, right? And that's it.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.